Good evening, my friends. My name is Danny, if you haven't had the chance to meet yet. And today is November 16th, which means Black Friday deals are in their second week of the... How did that happen? I don't know, but it's a thing now. And so perhaps you've already been doing your best, like I have, to find good deals for buying gifts for loved ones. There's something special about the perfect gift for a loved one, right? A gift that not only is wanted, but also says, like, I see you, I know what you don't like, I know what you do like. But there are also other times when one might receive what can be referred to as a gift fail. And so I had a few examples of this. First is the classic blanket that you once gave to somebody because you thought they actually would like it, and a few years go by and you get it back, but they clearly forgot that. Gift fail. Second one is, this is from an actual leader in a workplace who thought a bag full of nothing was a promising concept. If you can't read it, it says, I know this bag looks empty, but it's actually filled with our love. Yeah, right. Or perhaps you have a sibling who was going to give you something super generous, a gently used pair of AirPods, just to realize they never cleaned it. Okay. Gift fails. This isn't just a reality around Christmas or birthdays. Sometimes that's just life. That oftentimes how we can think of things, even when it comes to faith. Sometimes we can envision the realities that it feels like God has given us as if he invited us to a feast, but all he gave us were the table scraps, the leftovers. So when you think of God and what he provides in any sense of that, emotionally, spiritually, physically, are you convinced that God offers up a gift that misses the mark with you? Maybe it's for other people. He seems to really take care of them. Maybe they're like super spiritual or something. And like, they're like the super Christians, but you are like struggling. Last week, we celebrated baptisms, and that gave us the opportunity in the gathering to focus on what God has done in the stories of those who know and love him. That when someone comes to follow after Jesus, there's an acknowledgement of this desperate need for discovery of God's provision and care. But when we look at our world, if we're being honest, we know that we live in a world where there's just never enough to go around. There's not enough time in the day. There's not enough resources, not enough passion or energy or sleep or years. Everything is finite. Nothing is limitless. Now, that is a hard reality whether you ever experience the depths of scarcity or not. So, the tension that we all wrestle with on a number of topics, but including this one, is if God is all good, meaning he is the ultimate force of love and kindness in the cosmos, and if God is all great, meaning that he is powerful, that he is able to enact his desires, then why is our world filled with such scarcity? Is God offering up gifts that just miss the mark? Is he doing it on purpose? Well, when we open up the scriptures, what we discover is a God who is filled with infinite generosity. In each major world religion, there is a reason given for why their particular deity created, unveiled the cosmos. Almost always, those various gods do it out of some version of self-interest or a selfish desire internally. But see, when we open up the scriptures in the book of Genesis, we have a radically different view of creation. We find a God who doesn't need anything. He's self-sufficient. He's doing good. He doesn't need. And so the question is, then why would he create? He acts as if he is a cosmic host inviting all of creation to this wonderful feast. And the early pages of the scriptures, we see as the land and the skies and the seas are all created, and they're populated with different living creatures and beings. And he fills them with order and purpose, but not because he was missing something, but because it's an overflow of his generosity. We get this language early on when we're talking about the creation of humanity. Genesis chapter 1 says it this way. So God created humanity in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, over every living thing that moves on the earth. So notice what it says. And God blessed them. It doesn't say, and then God was like, y'all, I'm a pretty big deal. Bless me. Bring it. Come on, come on. Start it. Make much of me. Instead, what he does is he blesses humanity and he gives them cosmic purpose. The vision of existence that we're supposed to have in our minds when we look at the scriptures is a world of abundance and generosity, where God and humanity are called to partner together in fruitfully filling the lands with those who have been gifted with the ultimate gift, the very image of God dwelling within the human. Of course, that world of abundance and generosity is not what tomorrow will bring. At least not when we look at our bank account, when we look at our calendars, when we go to work, when we're hanging around with friends. We are aware with anything of limitations. Speed limitations, financial limitations, job limitations. Instead, what we have seen is that each of us fight with a world that's rooted in scarcity. And this, according to the scriptures, was brought in with the very first lie of the cosmos, believing that God was somehow holding back on humanity. Wisdom and insight, that there was a vision of the good life that God was somehow trying to stop us humans from getting to. And so the world of scarcity continues to expand from there. The desire to do things on our own, to strike it out on our own and do things in a way that makes most sense to you and I. And it's perpetually led to an understanding for humanity across cultures, across generations, across history, that this world is incredibly limited. And therefore, for me to win means others have to lose. Which is the first story that we get outside of the garden when the two brothers bring an offering before God. One is named Cain and the other is named Abel. Now, we're not given a ton of context to specifically clarify all of what Cain's offering was and why it was not sufficient. But what we get is detail about Abel's. Abel, we find out, offers up the first and best. So this is Genesis 4, verse 4 and 5. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock, meaning before there is clarity about the entire flock and how the entire flock's going to turn out, the firstborn was always believed to be the best, the strongest, the most likely to make it. And so what he does is he offers up to God the firstborn of the flock, his first, and of their fat portions. Fat portions is the choicest piece of meat in the ancient imagination. So anytime in the scriptures that you read about the fat portions of anything, that kind of like creeps me out a little bit when I'm going to barbecue and it's like it's a little too fatty. But in their mind and in the mind of some who still really like the fat portions of meat at barbecue, this was like, oh man, this is the best stuff. And so he is offering up to God his first and his best. And it says, and Yahweh had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry and his face fell. So again, what Abel is doing is he is offering up a sacrifice that is a demonstration of garden living. He is living, he is making a sacrifice that demonstrates a belief in a world of abundance, even though he indwells a world of scarcity. I'm going to live as if I live in the garden, even though I know that everything is finite. But then God says to the brother Cain, he says, why are you angry? Why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. So God's warning for Cain is one of scarcity. This isn't you or him. It wasn't that there had to be a winner and there had to be a loser. It's that if you do well, if what you brought was your first and your best out of a heart of faith, you'd be accepted. But here's the reality. This time around, your offering, it wasn't there. Likely his heart wasn't there. And that played out in terms of what he brought and offered up to God. But he says, if you enter in faith with me, living with an understanding that I am like the great cosmic host of this dinner party, then you're going to experience life. But here's the opposite reality of that. There is another path. And you're in danger of walking down it if you do not do well. Bro, you didn't do so well. Sin is crouching at the door. So the what's supposed to be taking place in our imagination is a beast. A beast that is crouching at the door of our hearts. Now, this beast has produced a lie. This beast whispers to you to cause anxiety within you, to scare you into a mentality that the God of the universe desires to hold out on you, that he desires to give you gifts that are gift fails. Cain, listen. If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. And what it's telling you is take matters into your own hands, because only one can be a winner and only one can be a loser. But its desires aren't for you. Have you ever felt that? When you, like that awareness, when you're being tempted into any version of brokenness, whether it's to use your words to harm, your actions to harm, your influence to harm, and and sin that is crouching at the door, what does it tell you? Yeah. It tells you, I'm for you. Everyone else is against you, but I got your back. No, its desire is contrary to you. So you must rule over it. You can't fall victim to it. Cain, though, takes the bait and he falls away. Now, Cain isn't the last to assume God is holding out on him. Instead, this assumption follows humanity straight into the story of the nation of Israel. And so generations have gone on, and God continues to pursue humanity, even though this rebellion is not ceasing. Over and over again, it's the same story playing out with a bunch of different characters with each generation. And God continues to pursue humanity in the midst, telling them, I am for you. It's against you. Sin is against you. There's a spiritual enemy who's against you. And over again, they cannot fathom what it means to live into a vision of a generous creator. Now, eventually, God leads the Israelites out of their enslavement in the nation of Egypt and into freedom. And at this point, we're supposed to think, yeah, sweet, we're going to get there. It's working, except freedom doesn't immediately look like a return to the garden, a return to a land of infinite abundance. Instead, they journey first into a wilderness. Now, in the scriptures, wilderness is a place of perpetual scarcity. And that's not just in the Bible. That's like if you go into any wilderness at all, you will find a lack of resources that are easy to access. Now, maybe you become like a survivor person and you start like making your own spears, cooking up some mushrooms that don't kill you, things like that, and you can survive. But the wilderness is not a place where life for humanity is easy to thrive. And it definitely wasn't for them because it was a desert wilderness. And so there seemed to never be enough for the daily preset menu. But Yahweh says to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain manna or bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day. Now, let's pause there. So it would come from the skies. Each morning they would walk out, and from the skies, God would have allowed to fall this miraculous bread dough. I'm assuming it's sourdough because that's what's popular right now. And you would take that dough and you would go and you'd griddle it into cakes over the fire and you would eat it, and it would sustain you for another day in the wilderness. But the reality is the land was covered in it. And so you could easily get more than enough for the day. You could get stuff for tomorrow, because what if God, he came through today, but what if he doesn't come through tomorrow? So he says, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my Torah, my law, my wisdom or not. Will they walk in relationship with me, in dependence on me, or will they try to take matters into their own hands again? Now, he even gives a caveat, though. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So in other words, on the seventh day, which is Sabbath, which is holy day, a day where you don't need to rest. Instead, you can rest in the presence of God, in the presence of community. So it's not just that the bread expires after one day of use, because on the sixth day, each time you can get enough for 2 days. And so what God is saying is, trust me, trust my plan. I promise it's going to help you endure. Now, this test seems kind of arbitrary, right? You have this sticky sourdough that's coming down from the skies that each morning covers the ground. And that seems arbitrary as a test, but what is it saying? Each day, God is proclaiming to the nation as they look out their tent and they see the food, trust me today, and then trust me tomorrow. And you'll trust me tomorrow by not gathering more for tomorrow. Now, that's all well and good, but what is scarcity whispering in? That's cool that he took care of you today. Cool. But you got to take control of your tomorrow, because otherwise, you're going to be dependent on him, and isn't that scary? Now, if you're anything like me, it's easy to read stories about people in the Bible like this and think, silly ancients, of course God's going to come through. I mean, read the next page. They didn't have it yet, and it was their future. So it's easy to think, guys, if there is heavenly sourdough outside tomorrow, you feel pretty confident, right? Like we would, because we're enlightened people and we know better. But think of how hard it is for you and I to live in daily dependence on God with or without the heavenly sourdough. Isn't it hard to rely on God? And the reality is, our struggle, my struggle, your struggle is rarely on matters of starvation or a full belly. Although for many, that's exactly the case around the world and even in our country. See, the test is about emotion, is about this emotional weight of a faith that is being built up, that is meant to be formative. It is not God looking to fail people. It is God seeking to grow his people through the wilderness. The call of God is to trust me that I am the generous host who's going to provide what I promised. If I promise it, it's going to happen. Now, this is a repetition of the Eden failure, right? Trust me, trust my path, trust my wisdom, trust my way. Now, centuries go by, and the Israelites find their way finally into a land of promise, except they don't live into the promise. They don't live as if they have been cared for by the God of abundance. Instead, they live perpetually entitled lives, lives bent on an understanding of scarcity, believing that for their nation to win, other nations must be destroyed. They must be pressed up against. And so what happens is it's as if God has been for centuries protecting his people by holding other nations at bay. And so after generations of consistent rebellion, of consistent walking away from God and his promises, it's as if God removes his hand and allows for a natural consequence to come. You want to do life like the other nations? You want to war like the other nations? You want to rebel against me like the other nations? You can do it. You can choose it, but you're also going to get the consequences of the other nations. And so what ends up happening is that the people of Israel are carted off into exile in a few different directions. No longer are they in the land of abundance, the land of promise. And so what they must now live into is a true world of what scarcity looks like, where God is not coming to the rescue in the ways that they had envisioned in the past. Except even there, God still wasn't giving up on his people. Instead, he would speak through prophets. And these prophets would be consistent reminders of God's provision, even in the wilderness, that even in the wilderness, he would build an oasis for his people. That his generosity would not be bound by humanity's inability to live into the great love that he has for them. So there's a prophet named Isaiah, and his scroll is just super cool. But there's one part in particular I wanted to focus in on right now. This is from Isaiah 55. And here's how it starts. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. Have you ever been really thirsty? If you ever went on a hike or been outside in Florida in the summer, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come buy and eat. But I don't have money. I don't have enough to receive the abundance. Come buy wine and milk. These were treasured possessions in the ancient world. Wine and milk without money and without price. So come into the cosmic grocery store and stock up your cart and check out and realize that I already paid the bill. Why though? Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me. Eat what is good. Delight yourselves in rich food, in the fattest portions, in the most delicious portions. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear that your soul may live, and I will make with you an everlasting covenant. My steadfast, sure love for David. That last part is mentioning King David, who is a man after God's own heart, an individual who had a unique love and relationship with God. And he's saying that same steadfast love that I had with David, that's the love I have for you. It's not for the super spiritual. It's not for those who get their name in the book. It's those who are beloved by me. This is your inheritance. Now, let's do actual hand raising for a second. Okay, did you hear the tone of God's voice in this, not just my interpretation of it? When I read that, did God seem reluctant? If God seemed reluctant and like he doesn't actually care for humanity, raise your hand. Okay. Did he sound eager? If he sounded eager, excited, desiring to lavish his people with love, go ahead and raise your hand. Okay, all right, we're all picking up on the same story there. Okay, this is God, but is this how you hear him? The way that you think he's talking to you, is this the way that you envision he's talking to you? Chances are not so much. Why? Because we are conditioned by scarcity. We're conditioned by our culture. We're conditioned by our family of origins. But listen to this language. If you are thirsty, come and drink. If you are starved out of your mind, come and eat. Come and take and eat and enjoy from my abundance. God is clarifying for anyone who would just listen up. I'm not withholding what is good for you, I promise. I want to give you the best I got. I want to invite you into a feast beyond belief. I want you to stop trying to figure it out how to do it by yourself. And trust me. Instead, what does he suggest that we humans default to? We spend our money on that which does not sustain us. We spend our money on that which does not satisfy us. We pull together our scraps of a meal in our own strength. We live in absolute ignorance that the Creator has already laid out a feast for us. Eat what is good. Delight yourself in rich food. Now, if you're anything like me, you struggle with this from time to time. I trust you, God. I absolutely trust you. And I want to trust you, but I trust you. But now things just got real. And so maybe if I don't make it happen this time, maybe I don't trust that you're actually going to show up. Maybe I'm not going to trust daily bread from you. If I don't pursue my career and my dreams with everything I got, if I don't buy the wardrobe that I desire oh so much, or the gadgets or the gizmos, of course, if I don't put my effort and energy into myself and bettering myself, then who will? Isn't this the cry of our generations right now? If I don't look out for number one, then who will? But when all of us just look out for number one, nobody wins. We stand in the wilderness and we face what I often call the Aladdin test, right? God asking, do you trust me? As he holds out his hand. And so all that is left is figuring out what would it take to get the heart of humanity then to actually live like that, that Isaiah 55 promise. How do we live into that? How would God reach out his hand to us and say, do you trust me? How does God ultimately prove that his feast is legit? For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, his firstborn, his best. God gave his first and his best, that whoever would believe in him should not perish, but instead have eternal life, life to the full, the good life, the whole life. In other words, God gave us his first and his best so that we could receive his first and his best. Not a secondary life, not a decent life, not a, well, it's better than the other place kind of life. To have eternal life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. This is the image of an extremely generous God. Just as Abel demonstrated the ultimate signal of trust in God's generosity by offering up his first and his best, God has sent us in the person of Jesus his first and his best. Not because God had to. God didn't owe you or me anything. It wasn't some random act of guilt that God's like, oh man, these humans are really messed up. I guess we got to do something about them. What can you do? I don't know. Other part of the Trinity, son, can you like maybe figure it out? No, like God did an intentional act of love because Jesus would be the lamb who was slain before the foundations of the world. God's level of intentionality within the life and death and resurrection of Jesus is unparalleled, is the ultimate act of generosity. That the Son of God would take on human form, experiencing all the difficulties that anybody, and if you're Jesus and you're going to come and occupy humanity at any point in time, are you choosing to go into a defeated, occupied, oppressed people group to not live as part of the oppressing class, but a part of the oppressed class? Does that sound like a great idea? Not so much to me. Maybe a neutral third party. I don't know, but not Jesus. He would come to experience a difficult life where you grew up watching the resources of your people and your land being extracted and sent off to enrich another kingdom. And there's this great power vacuum that is left by corrupt politicians and corrupt religious leaders who are enriching themselves off of the back of the poor and the powerless. And then he would experience hunger, sadness, joy, beauty, friendship, all in this human life. But he also continued to usher in a new paradigm of a different kingdom. A kingdom not filled with corruption or scarcity, but a kingdom of abundance where life and light and freedom would reign. And so he begins to call to himself some apprentices, some followers, and he teaches them about this new kingdom that he believes is being drawn near to us through himself. And so he would teach them over and over again about what we refer to as the way of Jesus, the way of living, the way of thinking, the way of believing, the way of desiring that matches the very heart and mind of Jesus. And one time his disciples are talking about, what is it? How do you pray? And so he teaches them, he says, pray like this. This comes from Matthew 6. Pray like this. Our Father in heaven, holy is your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our manna, our daily bread. And forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. All right, let's sit on this for a second. Your kingdom of generosity come. Pray like this. Not Danny's kingdom, not y'all's kingdom, not the kingdom of our nation, but your kingdom, God. Your kingdom of generosity come. Your will as the host of the cosmic feast be done. Where? Here and now. Give us the ability to trust in your daily provision of manna. We know that you're going to take care of us, but God, it's hard to remember that for tomorrow. Give us today our daily bread. Help us to rest in that. Help us to respond with the most scarce resource on earth, forgiveness. As you have generously doled out forgiveness upon us, help us to be able to generously dole out forgiveness on others. And then help us to pass the test. Unlike all those who have come before us, you know, you got your Adam, your Eve, your Cain, your Israelites in the wilderness. Unlike all of those who have come before us who perpetually fail the test, Lord, deliver us. Deliver us. Help see us through the test, not by our strength, but by yours. Deliver us, generous, holy, set apart Father. Help us. Help us live into your kingdom come, into your will being done. And so then Jesus would die on the cross. And at that point, the seed was planted by the shedding of the Son's blood. The ultimate sacrifice of the first and the best is not just in his presence. It's not that Jesus was just a really good version of human. He is God in the flesh. And so he gives the most immeasurably costly gift ever given in himself. But Jesus didn't stay on the cross. And he didn't stay in the tomb. Instead, death was put to death through his resurrected life. Scarcity was put in the grave. And what stepped out was a king who invites all of those who would follow after him to participate in the arrival of his kingdom. And so it starts with God's generosity towards us. This is why we actually took communion. If you've been around Mosaic for very long, it's a little different for us to take communion before the message. We typically do as a response from the message. It's a reminder for tonight that everything is a response to God's generosity on the cross, that what he has done, what we need to be reminded of is the good news that Jesus has done everything for us. And all we do is respond to that reality. And that's what the early church did. They lived as if this was all really true. It's as if they took Jesus at his word. Not always, not perfectly. But in Acts chapter 2, they did some crazy stuff. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers, and awe came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done through the apostles. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. Does that sound like any people group? this isn't normative stuff for our world. And you're like, well, that's because they're all like very similar in culture and experience. No, at this point, the church is already becoming geographically diverse because people had come in for a great feast and they had a festival known as Pentecost, and they had heard the gospel proclaimed, this good news of Jesus's generous love poured out. And people started responding, and this is what started happening. All who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belonging and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, they attended the temple together and they broke bread in their homes. They ate meals together. They received their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God, having favor with all the people. Now, here's the question. Does this sound like a scarcity mindset to you? You can shake your head no with me. No. Yeah, here's the thing. I guarantee you that the poorest person in this room makes by the percentage times 1,000 of their experience. If we were to update it for inflation, these people lived in abject poverty. Now, perhaps some of them were business owners and some of them had a lot, but most of them had very, very, very little. This is oppressed people group in the early century. These are people that literally were hoping to make sure that they had enough food through the harvest. And they didn't live as if the world was scarce anymore. They didn't live as if the world was scary anymore. They didn't live as if this world was a dog-eat-dog world. It was a zero-sum game of I get to win and you get to lose. They took Jesus at his word. They believed in God's ability to provide through supernatural and natural means. Here's what's so cool. That whole give us today our daily bread thing, we find out here how they got the daily bread from one another. They had meals together. They had a potluck. And as they all brought food to participate, they all got to eat. Now, that's just the physical daily bread, but there is the holistic understanding of daily bread that is the holistic care and provision of God for his people. And the way they received it is for one another, as they prayed for one another. Sometimes we can get this image of it would be so much easier to trust God if there was the sourdough dough outside, right, from heaven. If I got that, then my faith in God would be like so on point. Little do we see that God is providing all the time through his people. When we pray for one another, when we come together for a meal, when we see one another where there is a need. I had a friend from our community reach out to me saying, hey, when SNAP benefits were delayed, if you hear of anybody who has a need in that area, I would love to enter in generosity. Those kinds of things are what happens when you believe not, well, I have way too much money. I can do it. No, it's what when we believe that here's what I got. It's what God has given me. And so I'm going to take what God has given me and put it towards what God wants to do with it. And in the midst of that, we get to experience God's incredible love for us and the way that he takes care of his people. And so the early church lived as proclaimers of a generous king, that even though the reality was the world of scarcity didn't go anywhere. In fact, many of those first followers would end up at the point of death for their faith. For their allegiance to Jesus, they would die. They would have their businesses or their homes burnt down. They would be shuttered. They would be kicked off or cut out of society. That looks like scarcity. And yet they didn't live as if that was true. They lived into a truer reality than the mere physical world would dictate. They held on with trust and hope because they knew that the God who had given his first and his best would never leave them or forsake them. And can we be real? That's hard to remember when days feel really lean. When bad news sets in. When broken hearts happen. It's hard to remember that he will not leave us or forsake us. But that is the promise. That is the greatest promise that could ever be given. And it's hard to hold on to because it doesn't always feel like it's enough. It feels like a gift fail. But by faith, it is not. And so the early church lived into this reality that we talk of often, of the already and the not yet. Already, now, God has unleashed his kingdom, but not yet, because the completion of abundance hasn't happened. And that wasn't just the case then, it's also the case today. We still live in a world where bad things happen, where scarcity happens. But the early followers of Jesus held on in hope that when Jesus said, I'm coming back, and when I come, the kingdom is coming in its fullness, they held on to that as if it were true because they believed it was true. The trouble for you and I is it's hard to remember that every day. We hold on to it loosely. Like, for sure God's going to come through, but also I need to make sure that I'm taking care of everything on my own. Now, one day, though, one of Jesus' earliest followers named John received a vision, and it was a vision known as the Revelation. And there, what was proclaimed in this revelation was that a day when pain and suffering would be one day put to death, where justice and hope would reign over the universe, where this feast would finally be served. And though there's this ancient beast who would fight back before the commencement of the feast, the battle would never even be in doubt. And so at the end of this revelation, there is a vision of a kingdom of abundance and generosity. In Revelation 22, it says it this way, then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. Now also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. So river coming through the middle of the city. And on both sides of this garden city is one tree. And it has 12 different types of fruit on it. Now, what does that look like in reality? Zero clue, but sounds awesome. And it sounds generous that every month there is food. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nation. So even the leaves have a purpose. No longer will there be anything accursed, anything that is not filled with God's infinite blessing and generosity, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him, and they will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And so the vision that we get is not just a return to the garden in Eden. What we get is something more than just the garden in Eden. It is a garden city, where scarcity is forever eradicated, where death is undone, where human suffering is no more. Now, here's the reality, though. In our culture, the one we inhabit here, we envision that if we try harder, if we just go back to some golden age in our nation or our world's past, then we can get there to the good place. Or if we just try harder through technology and innovation, then we can somehow achieve this utopia. But either is a vision of a kingdom of abundance, and either is a really crummy place to put in all your hope. Not to throw shade at him, but I did hear this quote this week. Elon Musk said this week about AI and automation, you'll have robots plus AI, and we'll have, in a benign scenario, universal high income. Not just universal basic income, universal high income. He wasn't talking about 100 years from now. He's talking within the next decade. So what he envisions is that through technology, through innovation, we will get to a place where none of us will have to work. In fact, none of us will ever go hungry. Now, the idea that we have an entire culture where nobody goes hungry, that's a good thing. That it would be a great thing if kids never went to bed hungry, if people didn't die of preventable diseases. And so what human history, though, has shown is that while we can and should improve our world that we inhabit to be a more just and compassionate society, we have never been able to fulfill through any means of technology or governance. We've never been able to achieve that utopian society in our own power. The human condition always upends it. The human condition always makes it rough. And it is incapable of fulfilling our deepest hopes and longings, no matter how hard we try. And so the scriptures offers a different answer, a different answer than let's go back to a previous time or let's go forward to a better one. What it suggests is the now and the not yet. Already that we live on this side of the cross of Jesus. Already we have received the first and best sacrifice who has already been made on your behalf and mine. Already God has shown his abundance and generosity towards us. Not yet. Not yet is humanity fully trusting. And I'm not just talking about non-Christian tech geniuses. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about y'all. We struggle to fully trust Jesus. Day in and day out. It is the lifetime journey of a follower of Jesus. We struggle to trust that God really gives good gifts. We struggle to trust that God's way is actually better. We struggle when we don't get the promotion, when the relationship ends, when the diagnosis comes in. If you're anything like me, you struggle not to pin those things on God. Asking God, where were you then? When the response is always, I was right here. I'm right here and I'm not going anywhere. My presence is in abundance with you. In the not yet, the world we inhabit, not all the broken things have been made untrue. And not yet do we have answers for all the scarcity and all the suffering that still occurs. But already here's what we know, that he will never leave us or forsake us. Already, here's what we know, that the great host of the cosmos wants to expand his kingdom through us. And so each day we wrestle with the same test that God's people have always wrestled with. Will I trust him or myself? Will I trust his generosity or my Amazon shopping cart? Will I trust his kindness or the fulfillment that I believe the next big thing will give me? And the invitation that he has for us is to enter into the world of the first and the best. This is the difference between believing that life is for your own pleasure and your own comfort and your own benefit versus living as if we are those whom God has entrusted with gifts that are meant to be passed on to others. Over the course of this year, we've talked about this vision of one more life, that we get the incredible opportunity to participate with God in reaching those who do not yet know Jesus, that we get the opportunity to encourage people with the wonder and truth of the gospel, that we get to share about the overflow of God's love toward us and through us. That we would go after the one more locally and globally as we live in fearless generosity. That we would live as a conduit of God's generosity. That we would see his kingdom expand as we give in generosity what he is doing throughout the local church. See, here is something that's so important and so easy to miss. Generosity is not something that we just do. It is something that God is forming in his people. Now, I happen to be married to someone who exudes generosity. My wife, Allie, loves to give and to care and to help people in the midst of their needs. So a few years back, we received a generous, but not like life-changing inheritance from a family member who had passed away. And it was unexpected and it was incredible that like just that love demonstrated through the generosity being sent our way. And so that was really kind. And so immediately I began to think of all the projects that Allie and I had talked about. And like, man, okay, we're going to do that. Now we can actually do that. We don't have to save for like 5 years to do that thing. That'd be really cool. So I like immediately went in that mode. Now, Allie's mind, on the other hand, immediately thought of a friend of ours who had mounting medical debt from their child's ongoing medical issue. And their family was just trying to stay afloat. And so Allie said to me, God gave us this money. We get to join him in caring for them. Let's write a check. Now, I love that idea. I did. But I also love the idea of a few more house projects getting done and that there was a tension there, right? Because there was only so much that was deposited into our account. And so we began to pray and God in his kindness began to help me see that and remind me that I am not the owner of whatever is in my bank account, matter how much or how little. I am merely a conduit of his generosity. He was generous to us so that we could then be able to be a conduit of that generosity to others. Now, hopefully you get in this story that I am for sure not the hero of the story, right? In fact, neither is Allie. We were blessed by getting to participate in God's care for his kiddos. Our friends got to experience the generosity of God, God's daily bread provision. All we were this like this really small conduit of that. It was God's generosity, not mine, not Allie's. This is the invitation for us. That is, we have received the first and best from God. We respond in generosity with our first and our best, not as a random act of guilt, but as an intentional response of worship. Now, earlier this year in April, many of us made specific commitments to this One More Life journey that we were taking together to serve, to give, and to share the gospel. Now, we are officially at the halfway point in that first year of the One More Life journey. And so when it comes to give, for many of us, this might be just a reminder like, oh, shoot, I forgot about that. But but the reality is for some of us, financial pictures do change over the course of the year. There are job losses. There's unexpected medical expenses and stuff like that. So none of this is meant to be legalistic or guilt-ridden or shameful. In fact, this is why as a church, we don't do things that other churches might do. And there's not a problem with it, but we don't pass baskets each Sunday, actually ever. Why? Because what we don't want to happen is that it would be misconstrued that a call to generosity is meant to be perceived as a random act of guilt, but instead an intentional act of worship, a response to the God who loves us in abundance. And so I'm going to invite the band to come on up. Now I would love for all of us to just close our eyes and just allow us to come to a space of quietness in our hearts. I wanted to ask you this simple question. What does it look like for you to respond to God with your first and best? For some of you, you're a part of this community and this vision of going after the one more and living in generosity in our community is yours to take hold of. And so perhaps for you, if you are a part of this community, it's to be intentional and to budget for generosity each month or each pay period. And that could be the same case for you if this isn't your home church and you are part of another local church. Wherever you call home, let that be the first space of your first and best. And there are so many other wonderful gospel causes, mission partners, nonprofit organizations who are doing wonderful work, friends that just need a little bit financial help. Perhaps for you, it's to serve God with your time rather than with what is just left over after your hobbies or your vacation. It's to offer God your first and best with your disposable time. Perhaps it's to be intentional in conversations with those who you know who do not yet know Jesus. Not just doing that thing that's so easy for us to do, like to wait until maybe one day they kind of bring up something spiritual and they ask you specifically like, who is Jesus? Why did he die on the cross? And what does it matter that he rose again? And you're like, oh, now that's my invitation. But instead, it is an intentional part of your prayer life.